What number is this, Chip?
Episode 3.
The Monkeys Live!
Okay, no, I mean, like, don't get excited, man. It's because I'm short, I know.
You're listening to Zilch, a Monkeys podcast.
Yes, sir.
Countdown 3, 2, 1. See, how's that? Welcome to Zilch. Fine listeners, how are you doing today? We thank you for spending some of your valuable time with us. And today we're doing a special episode where we're going to talk about the Monkees experience live. Monkees alive. So, woo-hoo. There we go. Today I'm joined by Jeff Hewlett.
How's it going?
Craig Cohen.
Hi, Ken. Hi, listeners.
And Sarah Clark. And later we'll be joined by Craig Smith. He'll be on part of our live discussion later. But right now, we're going to check out the Monkees mailbag and check out listener responses.
P.O. Box 9847.
And of course, one of the best ways to get mentioned on the Zilch podcast is to rate us on iTunes, and we thank you so much for doing that. It really helps keep us up there. Ever since the show debuted, we have not been out of the top 20, and it's because of people like you giving us iTunes ratings, so please keep it up.
So awesome.
So Craig Cohen, please read the first one.
Yes, and it's from Rich 8 Greg, and it has possibly the best headline ever, which is simply, woohoo!
Sounds like a Blur song.
And the review is a great place to rewind and hold time with a group of Monkeyites. So very cool. Thank you, Rich.
I love that. Yeah, I love that. It sounds like a race from Star Trek. The Monkeyites need some carbonite or something. Anyway, I'm failing miserably.
At least you tried.
Yeah.
Mick Smitty says it's a barrel of fun. It's finally here, a Monkees podcast, and it's awesome. This was exactly what he wanted in a podcast about the Monkees. Reviews, trivia, audio clips, guests, interviews, and so much more, and they're only 2 episodes in. Can't wait for the next installment. Thanks, Zilch. Keep monkeying around.
And we plan on monkeying around every chance we get, right, guys?
Oh, yeah. Totally.
Yep.
And of course, when I say guys, I'm including Sarah, so...
Yeah. It's a gender neutral, guys.
We are all monkey men here.
Exactly.
This looks like a job for monkey men. Up, up and away!
JDR Cape Cod writes, excellent podcast, can't wait for the next one. Informative, professional, and downright fun. I'm a first-generation Monkee fan and have enjoyed learning more about the band. It's great to hear about the point of views from different generations of fans. Thank you. Well, we thank you, and we also thank you for telling folks about us. Our Facebook page is hopping right now. There's so many great conversations going on. If you want to be involved, it's pretty much minute by minute through the day. We're all discussing Zilch and Monkees and all sort of monkey business, so it's fantastic. We encourage you all to join us there. Find our Facebook page at facebook.com/groups/ZilchMonkeyCast. One word. You want to read the next one, Craig?
CBK9001. Says the Podfather does it again. Ken has given us yet another fun and informative podcast, this time featuring the Monkees. Like Podkist and Cheap Talk with Trick Chat, the emphasis is on the music and fun, and you can't get much more fun than the Monkees. Thanks for another great show, Ken. Smiley face. With a wink.
Oh, gosh. Do you guys remember that one scene where the Monkees are introducing one another from Captain Crocodile? And
oh, yeah.
Mike says something like, to my left is the charming and delightful Davy Jones. And Davy says, thank you. Mike goes, no sweat. And I just always, that always cracked me up. I'm going to play that right now.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Mike Nesmith. And on my left is the delightful and charming personality, David Jones.
Thank you, Mike.
No sweat.
And on my left is the charming and delightful Peter Tork.
David.
And on my charming and delightful is the left moderator, Nikki Dolenz.
Thank you, my charming panel. And now let's play What's My Scene?
Yeah, that always makes me laugh. No sweat. It's amazing how he can just, yep, just boom those little zingers, you know. They all had their cool skills. You want to read the next one?
Rhode Island Rock says, thank you. First it was the Podkist, then it was Cheap Talk, now Zilch. It's about time there was a Monkees Podkist, and I will not miss an episode. I'm a casual fan from back in the late 70s and mid-80s when the TV show was in reruns, had a couple greatest hits cassettes. After the first three episodes of Zilch, I'm starting to track down all the Monkee albums in order so I can enjoy them along with the discussion. Keep up the great work.
So we're selling more records for Rhino.
Right on.
So please don't kill us, Rhino.
Well, hey, maybe I don't know, free ad space or something.
There you go. By the way, we are going to play some ads soon on Zilch, but I want to make something clear. We're not getting any money from anything we quote-unquote advertise. It's just our way of saying you should check these people out. It's nothing to do with any monetary gain on our part or anything, but it's things that we think that you might be interested in. Does that make sense, guys?
Yep.
Oh, yeah.
Matter of fact, here's one right now.
Hi, Zilch fans. This is Melanie Mitchell. Be sure to check out my book, Monkey Magic, a book about a TV show about a band. It's a lighthearted review and companion for the TV show that made the 60s fun. The paperback is available online from Amazon or Barnes & Noble, and the ebook can be bought anywhere that fine ebooks are sold. Check out the Monkey Magic Facebook page. Follow me on Tumblr at bluemoonalto.tumblr.com and listen for my contributions here on Zilch, a Monkees podcast.
Greg, you bought Melanie's book. What do you think of it?
I'm really enjoying it. It's a neat concept, neat format, and it's a real handy guide to have when you put on an episode.
And Sarah, I know you're a big fan of the book as well.
Well, I kind of got to read it before a lot of people did because I helped Melanie with the fact-checking on the episode, which is like the coolest job ever.
Yeah, what a fun job to have to
watch
the Monkees.
I got money, like actual money to fact-check a Monkees episode guide. I still need to call my mother and tell her, and you thought this would not be useful later in life, but...
There you go.
She put a lot of love and care into it, as you can tell by reading it, but she really dug deep, not just into the story of the show itself and the episodes, but also kind of into the cultural context and how it kind of ties into the wider issues that were going on during the time the show was on the air. So it's just in general a great book about pop culture in the 60s.
And of course, Craig and Jeff are going to be heading up something really cool. This is something that's very interesting that a lot of the podcasts I've been involved with before, they're either about a band or a TV show or something. This is a podcast about a band and a TV show and current events and anything we want it to be. You guys are going to be doing episode commentaries that the fans can watch right alongside the Zilch staff. So that's pretty cool. You ready for that, Jeff?
Oh, sure. Yeah, we've been doing the same thing with another show that we do, and this will be a natural fit for us. I'm looking forward to it. I've got my Monkees box sets ready to go, and we're going to dive right in and run a commentary on each one.
Excellent, and I know you guys are going to kill it. Just two last little responses here. Tom Powers writes, I dig the show a lot, all in capital letters there, but please stop using the word Mr. every time you mention someone's name. Thank you, Mr. Tim Powers. He wrote that. I didn't add that, though, but it's just me... I'm just trying to be respectful of the other host and guest. So if I slip up and do it again, I apologize, but you never know when respect might rue its head someday. So
that's funny, Ken. I thought you were just constantly plugging my Twitter handle.
Which is?
Mr. Craig Cohen.
I'll see how we work that in. And the last one, and this one made my wife roll her eyes, but Akiro XKE writes, good show, but this Ken Mills sounds suspiciously like Michael Nesmith. Not only in his voice, but even in the metaphors and the descriptive phrases he uses, sounds uniquely Nesmithian, which is it's a nice word. It's a big word like gymnasium. Mm-hmm. Also, his microphone sounds like the one used on either Tapioca Tundra or Magnolia Sims. And I got that from the Nesmithian Institute. But if it isn't Nez, he could definitely get a job in a Monkees tribute band.
New career path.
There you go. All I need is the wool hat, you know. Yeah, my wife's getting me a wool hat for Christmas, so, you know. Hey, you know, love's the ultimate trip, so I'm working on it. So, you know, I'll work on it. So, anyhow. We'd also like to thank the lovely Miss Sherry Hansen for her wonderful photography, great pictures, and some of her clips. She is indeed a sunny girlfriend, and thank you, Sherry. Today we're going to talk about the Monkees live. And it's strange because we've seen entertainment change so much since the first time the Monkees ever had to perform live on stage, and the whole controversy over whether they play their own instruments or not, at this point, would not matter at all. Would you guys agree?
Oh, yeah, totally. Totally.
Of course. Yeah.
Yeah. All people want nowadays is a good show, an entertaining show.
They want their money's worth.
Mm-hmm.
And it's strange that the Monkees had to fight for approval where other bands didn't have to, and we found out that a lot of those bands back in the 60s didn't play their own instruments as well. And the guys in the Wrecking Crews that were on the Monkees album were also on the Beach Boys albums and other acts. Yeah. And it's just sort of strange. Here's a clip from Peter Tork with an interview that he did last year discussing that.
You guys were so chastised at the time for the not playing your own instruments. And then, you know, the Wrecking Crew comes out and we find out nobody played their instruments. The Beach Boys didn't play. I thought Carl Wilson was doing all those great guitar licks. It's Glenn Campbell, the Association, using the Wrecking Crew.
That's right.
Why were you guys singled out when everybody else was doing it?
Well, I can't tell you the total truth about that. All I know is that there was something about the energy in, you know, listen, I'll tell you a funny story. Mm. At the time, with the flack we took, I was feeling it, you know. And all the Hollywood musician lads were saying, oh, man, those four talentless slobs can't make a record to say they can't play their way out of a paper bag. Just four no-talent musicians that they just plucked off the street. Anybody could have done it. The TV show isn't bad, but the music is just the worst. Come to find out years later that the New York City actors struggling in the small theaters in New York, four talentless actors, they just plucked any four slobs off the street. Anybody could have done what they did. Those TV shows were just awful. The music wasn't bad, but the TV
show. Oh, I never heard that.
That's my own experience. I was talking to some New York actor kids, and that's what they were telling me. Oh, man, I don't believe it.
Didn't you play on, you played on the first album, the Nesmith song?
Oh, yeah, I was fourth chair guitar. It was just barely, it was just a little sop. It threw me. So there was some participation. But, you know, the business of making a record, when we did Headquarters, we sat in the studio and thrashed out the arrangements and who's going to play what and can I do this and is it all right, what do you think if I do this? Nah, that won't work, you know, or how about if you do that and this, you know, really crank. We did the kinds of things that are often done by arrangers in their own private rooms and, you know, and then you get the studio musicians, you knock off three songs in a three-hour session. And we took 3 weeks of that to make a 12-cut album. Mm. Now, I think it's a great little album, and I don't think it cost any more to make than the old ones did, and it lasted on the charts longer than the earlier ones did. It didn't do as well overall, but it did last, which is, to me, a real mark. It says that we reached in there and gave the people something that was more substantial than the original bubblegum stuff. Not that there's anything wrong with that stuff,
yeah,
but this was more substantial, I think.
It holds up when you listen to it today. It really does.
And, of course, that was a clip with Steve Goddard interviewing Peter Tork from back in August of 2013. But it's kind of strange when you think about it, how much they had to fight and how much they had to work through to, A, become a functioning band that could do tours, and to prove that they could actually do it. What are your thoughts on it, Jeff?
This is one of the things that fascinated me about the band when I first learned about them as a young guy. I mean, my uncle who was playing me the music was giving me the whole rundown on the band and how they were kind of a, you know, contrived at the beginning, and then they kind of fought for independence and became a real band, and that really drew me in. So I love hearing them talk about that, because it's just a fascinating process to me, because it's something that 99.9% of bands never will ever have to go through.
Jeff hit on it pretty good, and I know from my perspective, I don't really ever remember when I got into the band it being an issue at that point, because the episodes were 20 years old at that point. They had proven themselves, and as a, you know, early teenager watching the episodes, they were playing their instruments. So for all I knew, they were playing their instruments.
Right. Well, it's weird, because when I was a kid, you know, I think we were discussing this the other day. We were watching a Star Trek clip, and we noticed that one of the actors, when there was an action scene, grew about 6 inches, and then you watch, mm-hmm. like, let's say you're watching, there's a Batman episode on with the 60s Batman, and you see the guy who's supposed to be Robin during the fight has a mustache that they pancaked over, and you see Cesar Romero's mustache. But when you were a kid, you saw none of this stuff. It's kind of like in The Wizard of Oz, when they're climbing up the mountain, and I think the scarecrow is holding on to the lion's tail. As an adult, I see a block of wood holding the lion's tail inside the costume. But I didn't pick up on that when I was, like, 6. You know what I'm saying? Right. But there's a lot of things that we see now, and it's strange when you see the guys, and it's like, wow, that person's not even trying to master that instrument there. But it, then again, it's no different than some hair metal videos that we were deluged with in the 80s. How do you like that word, deluged? Or
love it.
But what did you guys think of the Monkees in the 60s as far as a live act? I'm sure you've all heard the Monkees Live 67 disc and stuff like that.
Yep, they sure did love their onstage banter.
Yeah.
Really, this was true of a lot of the shows up till 2012. It was like part concert and part
comedy
stage
act.
Show,
yeah.
Really. They were trying to bring elements of the TV show into it as well. But kind of coming back to what you were talking about earlier about the whole authenticity debate, I think a lot of it, and I think this is why the tours were so important to them personally and professionally, is that there was this impression, right or wrong, and I don't think it, for the most part, it's correct, there was this kind of impression in the wider music critic community that the Monkees hadn't, quote, paid their dues.
Right.
Because, of course, they'd been selected out of an audition process and basically handed a TV show and top 10 hits and all that sort of thing. And so they kind of had to, like you were saying earlier, had to go through that backward process of proving their authenticity after they made it big. At least finally, I think we've gotten to the point where they don't have to do that anymore.
If the Monkees were going to outsell the Beatles, they would have to tour. And if they were going to tour, they would have to play their own music. The boys filmed the TV show, then spent hours practicing their songs. The pace was grueling.
It was so intense that, you know, it's like, I don't know, being in a plane crash or something, or a car wreck, you know, you're in shock.
The sessions were indeed intense, and there was little time to prepare for their first major gig. Monkees historian Gary Strobel.
And they performed their very first concert in Honolulu, Hawaii, on December 3rd, 1966.
And the idea of that was that we went so far away from the mainland that if we bombed out, no one would know. That was the idea. And we went and played Miss Teenage America.
Being on stage after the initial abject terror of being out there playing, I mean, I had been in groups before, but I was playing a new instrument. I'd only had about a year to learn.
None of that seemed to matter. The boys, who critics said couldn't sing and couldn't play, electrified an army of crazed young fans.
Could not hear anything anybody else was doing, and there was 25,000 teenage girls screaming their guts out. Very quickly, you know, the line between fantasy and reality disappeared. When did we become a group? What defines a group? Is it when you travel on a bus and do one-nighters? Is it when you record? Or is it when you play live? I think when we finally went on the road and played live, you know, I suppose that was the moment.
Despite their success in concert, Monkees Mania did not impress the critics. They were relentless, accusing the foursome of being phonies. The criticism outraged the entire group, especially Peter Tork and Mike Nesmith. The music business was threatened by the Monkees' very existence.
At the time, there was a lot of animosity about the Monkees from the radio industry, because you had to know the right people. I don't know how to put this gently, and you had to pay the right people. Hey, what the hell? Payola. You know, it still exists and did back then. All of a sudden, the Monkees comes along, and the radio stations had to play the songs, whether they liked it or not.
You know, something that I remember, and I'm not going to add much to what my previous two colleagues have said there, but one thing that when I was a young kid, I remember my uncle played me some of the early Beatles live recordings, and I remember being annoyed by them because of the amount of screaming was going on by the audience. And I remember when I got a copy of the Monkees Live 1967, I realized that the Beatles weren't the only band that had that problem.
Yeah,
the Monkees mm-hmm. also suffered from that problem where, you know, if you listen to live recordings of them, you know, in that time period, it's just a endless stream of screams from the audience. So, I mean, you know, you think of that as an indication of popularity. I mean, that speaks volumes.
When you read Andrew Sandoval's book, talks about the reviews, and people say it was a very entertaining show, very loud. Unless you were in the first couple rows, you didn't hear too much. Another thing I found in rereading that book this week, there was something that just really caught my attention. And when you think about the Monkees doing this sort of thing, you know, you like, for example, the Monkees weren't allowed to give interviews and stuff like that, and the press didn't know what to make of that. In January of 1967, on Monday the 2nd, they were playing the Civic Center Arena in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Tickets were a whole $4, and they were sponsored by radio station KAKC. The group performs tonight to 8,500 fans in Oklahoma with a set that includes I Wanna Be Free. While the song was playing, scenes of the Freedom March in Montgomery, Alabama were projected on a screen behind the band. The group's stay at the Mayo Hotel, the concert gross is $38,119. So thank you, Andrew Sandoval, for that.
Nice.
And that really surprised me to be, you know, back in that time, back in the 60s, during when all that was going on, that was fairly bold. And the manufactured image with no philosophy, it seemed like there was some philosophy there, and I thought that was very cool and very brave.
I think some of it, I want to say it was Timothy Leary wrote a bit about the Monkees and basically talked about how they would bring these subversive thoughts in under the radar. I can't remember the exact quote. And you see it a lot in the episodes, too. I mean, where they're playing the dominoes game that's called Southeast Asia and things like that. And, of course, pretty much the Hall of Head is like that.
Yeah, exactly. Obviously, none of us ever saw the band back then. I would have been, like, you know, 5. I guess none of us really got to see the Monkees until the 80s, probably, right?
Yep.
Anybody attend any of those shows?
I did, yeah. 87 at the Arts Center here in New Jersey. Weird Al Yankovic had opened up for them, so that was a double whammy show for me.
Yeah, it sounds like a good one.
Okay. Second best opening act they ever had.
Whoa, wait a minute. I would say best, but who's better?
Right.
Hendrix.
Well, you know, he got booed off stage practically.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I would love to just see that juxtaposition.
Yeah,
he was very underappreciated at the time by the Monkees fan base, so that's a tough one.
Well, the Monkees fan base was 12 at the time, so it is understandable.
Do you guys think that you would get the Monkees today if it was a new band that came out? Do you think that you'd, like, get into them? Same music, same everything. Do you think you'd enjoy it?
Mm. With the TV show and everything?
Yeah.
Well, you can't argue with those songs.
Right.
Yeah, I find it's a tough hypothetical for me. It's like I just can't see those songs being put out today.
Exactly.
You know, looking at what's being put out today. I mean, even if you watch, you know, networks like ABC Family and you know, the stuff that they put on there is just nothing even close to what the Monkees were or what they are. And it's you know, the subject matter is so far different.
And I don't think you can have something like the Monkees unless you have an entertainment conglomerate, you know, the machine behind them that could bring in the TV and the excellent music and the concerts and the everything. Mickey's made the parallel to Glee a few times, and Glee gets close, but it's still not exactly the same thing. I think in just some ways the infrastructure has changed so much that I don't think you could get that phenomenon in the same way anymore, at least not in the music world.
Agreed. Here's the question. What is your favorite Monkey song that they've ever played live? Doesn't matter the lineup or the year. Jeff Hewlett.
Wow, that's a tough question. It's hard to even grasp what I would even answer that with. I mean, I heard a, I didn't witness this, but I heard a copy of the Porpoise song done live, which is one of my favorites.
That's great.
So I might have to go with that.
Okay. Craig, go on.
Listen to the band.
Oh, wow. Right out the gate. No thinking twice. Just boom. Sarah Clark.
Can I have a tie?
Sure.
Door into Summer, because that has just epic. Also, As We Go Along, just because that was actually my husband and I's first dance song at our wedding, and getting to go to a concert together and hear Mickey sing it was just wonderful.
That's excellent. An awesome song for a wedding, by the way.
Yeah,
it was perfect.
I'm going to say you can't go wrong with Pleasant Valley Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
So let's check out this live track, and on the other end of it, we're going to join Craig Cohen, Craig Smith, and Sarah Clark as they talk about the Monkees in more recent years live.
We took over the radio station. We thought we'd find us the prettiest little 18-year-old girl that we could and bring her into the station and talk to her. And we're on the air now. Be cool.
Let me ask you, if you really found out that none of us could play a note and couldn't carry a tune in the bucket, would you hate us?
No.
No? Why is that?
Well, because you're putting people on pretty good, if you don't.
That's great. Okay, well, for those skeptics out there who still don't believe we don't play our own instruments, come down and tell them you know me, and I'll get you in free.
This is Craig Cohen, and I have with me today Craig Smith.
Cheers.
And Sarah Clark.
Hello.
Guys, it's been actually a kind of busy time for the Monkees in terms of touring. Mm-hmm. Since 2011, they've pretty much done some kind of tour every year, no?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, they have, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, which is pretty pretty remarkable when you think about it. So do we want to take a look at, I guess, that 2011 tour, which was the 45th anniversary tour, and it was also Davey's last tour?
Yeah, I saw that tour. Sarah, you did not see this tour, correct?
No, I had to miss out on that one.
Okay. I've seen the Monkees quite a bit since 87. 87 and 89 were great setlist years. 2011 was incredible. You have, I believe, Davey kind of organizing the set list and putting the band together and kind of in charge of all that. Some very interesting songs that were done on this tour. They delved into the Missing Links for, I believe, the first time ever, doing I Don't Think You Know Me. They did Words, which is not something that they did very often. They did All of Your Toys. On select shows, Davey did Hard to Believe. This was the first tour where they did Head in its entirety. Davey did When Love Comes Knocking at Your Door. They did Saturday's Child. So lots of really, really cool tracks. And of course, you know, the main thing about this tour is that it would be Davey's last. But it was a great set list, and one of those shows where they easily did like 35, 40 songs, and they don't quite do that anymore. The trade-off between then and now, to use a pun, you have more of a kind of a raw garage band kind of sound now, whereas, you know, all the tours with Davey were very polished, and this is going to sound insulting, but a lot of the arrangements at times seem to border on Vegas-y and not very true to the originals. But having said that, it was a great tour, and sadly, you know, the last time that we would see Davey perform. The one thing that I do recall during the Philly show was during Someday Man, Davey saw a woman who was near the front and getting out of her seat to go to the bathroom or leave or do something. And he started to chastise her kiddingly from the stage and like jumped off the stage and went out and grabbed her and danced with her in the aisle to keep her there,
which was great and kind of a great memory of the last time that I got to see Davey on stage.
Yeah, that is a really cool story, and also illustrates the fact that even if they were sort of working from the same set list, they weren't in that like sort of Vegas robot go through the set where even our ad libs are going to be scripted.
Right.
Yeah.
And we've had that share of monkeys over the years. You know, there have been gags that have stayed tour after tour after tour, and this was. I mean, maybe this, I was looking at this maybe with fresher eyes because I hadn't seen them in so many years. I think the last time that I'd seen them before that may have been 2001, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, I think that was their last tour before the 2011, and I saw that one as well, and I know what you mean about the stale gags and such.
But
yeah.
I mean, you know, the thing always with Monkees tours is, you know, when you're seeing one, you think it's the last, because there have been, you know, enough kind of inter-band squabbles and tours gone wrong and things like that, and, you know, sometimes they are a volatile working unit. So the times when they weren't touring, I actually thought that I would never see them again. And, you know, looking at this last tour with Davey and, you know, where we are now, which is something I never thought I would see, it's kind of interesting the way the things play out.
Yeah, so 2011 was the 45th anniversary tour, and that was Dolan's, Jones, and Torque.
Yes.
No Nesmith. Now, in terms of that tour from a personnel standpoint, I know on the recent tour, you sort of got this three guitar attack at the front of the stage. Has Mickey really, does he not sit behind the drums anymore?
He sits behind the drums during the headquarters set and at points in head.
Okay.
Yeah, he's still on the drums a lot. And then he plays in the cajon box, I think is how it's pronounced in Sweet Young Thing.
What do you think is the reason for the quote-unquote adventurous set that they presented in 2011? A lot of times you think that bands normally say, well, our audiences only want to hear the songs they know. And a lot of bands don't give their audience credit, where it seems like the Monkees have sort of done the opposite. Do you know any reason why that was?
Well, I mean, an interesting thing about these songs are the lengths of the songs. You can have the Monkees do a 35-song set list, and 20 of them can be hits.
Yeah.
Or, you know, well-known album cuts, and you can still fit 15 really deep cuts. It's just because the set was so... I mean, it was packed in. There wasn't a lot of downtime. You know, there wasn't a lot of chatter. It was kind of like, you know, bam, 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 and the hits kept coming at you. I remember on the Heart and Soul videotape, the VHS from 87, they credit Davey, essentially was the one that picked the set list and things like that. And I think that Davey had always had a good grasp on that stuff. I mean, and on a lot of those tours, except, you know, some of the ones in the middle that kind of had like an interesting track here and there, there usually was a good bit of variety, except for that first 86 tour, which was kind of by the numbers.
Yeah.
Every tour after that had some kind of surprise. Like I said, in 87, it was Through the Looking Glass and Hold On Girl. And then in 89, they started doing D.W. Washburn and As We Go Along. And some of these tracks we've heard more over the years. But at the time, it was crazy to hear that stuff. And it seemed like every tour, they'd bring out some really new, cool songs.
Yeah. Is there a highlight for you from that 2011 date?
Seeing all of your toys was great. It's is that a sigh of regret?
Yes, that was an I Myself Am Deeply Jealous moment.
Anyway, I'm going to play the thing on this thing. It's a tune called All of Your Toys.
Yeah.
Two. I, five, four. Just like calling a time.
Yeah, it was. I think that was the one. I think that and Someday Man. Both of those songs were just great to finally see. And Saturday's Child, that was great as well. Another track that I just never thought they'd ever pull out. You know?
A lot of women had their first opportunity writing for the Monkees. There's a guy that I liked especially. He's the only guy that I could look straight in the eyes, Mr. Paul Williams. Some people always complain that their life is too short, so they hurry along. They keep on searching for pleasures and looking so hard they can't see. As for me, I've got all the time in the world. I was born someday man of the lady child. And looking for reasons they're never gonna find. They keep on searching for pleasures and looking so hard that they can't see. As for me, life can be a sweet holiday.
Baby.
did they start working with the sort of video playback screen? Because that looks like a really cool aspect of their show. Were they doing that back in 2011?
They did. I believe that was the first tour that Andrew Sandoval put together a kind of audio-video package for. And they would not only show video, for the first half hour or so before the show, it was all unheard rarities and video clips. Like, they would show the video for Oh My My. They'd play an alternate mix of All the King's Horses that wasn't anywhere else, you know. So you had to go early and kind of, and, you know, a lot of people in the audience had no idea. They were just kind of sitting there waiting for the Monkees to come on stage. But for the diehards, it was like, mm-hmm. wow, this is some really cool stuff being presented here as a kind of, I don't want to say throwaway, but, you know, it's something that's going on as you're coming in. You might not be paying attention, but for the people that were paying attention, it was great.
Yeah.
And Andrew did that tour, and 2012 and 2013 did all the video production for that tour.
Yeah, and that was in lieu of an opening act?
Correct, yeah. Which was another great thing.
I kind of dig that.
Yeah, I do too. Aside from Weird Al in 1987, yeah, I mean, it's yeah, you don't go there to see. I mean, there are certain bands that you just don't want to sit through an opening act to wait for. And yeah. The Monkees, you know, have a big enough berth of material that they can fill a good 2+ hours.
Yeah, yeah. Can we talk a little bit about the other people that are on stage with them I guess now and also in 2011? It's a pretty hearty band backing them
up.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, it's wonderful. Yes.
And I think it was fairly similar. Yeah, I don't know if I remember enough about who was in the band in 2011, but a lot of the mainstays were there. I mean, like Avio was there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but I don't know if there were any switch outs in particular.
You're looking at a pretty full band, keys, bass.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they kind of strip it down when Headquarters comes on.
So, you know? Yeah, almost like, I guess, like it was back in the 60s, just them, huh?
They might have had one or two people supplementing them, but it wasn't the full band. And then they kind of filled her back on.
In 2012, it was the Headquarters set was literally just the three of them playing. 2013, the band kind of helped them out a little bit more, and it basically just made the sound a little fuller on the Headquarters set, but they were still definitely playing lead, and I can't speak to this, the 2014 tour, unfortunately. But.
Yeah.
So is there anything else we want to talk about related to that 2011 tour before we move on?
There is an interesting thing that I can speak to. When looking at the merchandise, I remember the friend that I was with was very offended that they took the Headquarters album cover, I believe it was Headquarters, on one of the shirts and airbrushed Mike out. And she thought that for an iconic image like the Headquarters album cover, that was like sacrilegious. Which, again, is strange, seeing that the turn of events that happened years later, where now we're looking at pictures taken in 66, 67, where Davey is now cut out of these shirts, and the tour books completely consist of pictures of the three of them, or chopped so that Davey isn't included. So it's an interesting kind of turnabout thing.
Yeah, you think any of that's related to rights issues, or
from what I understand, there are issues, and I don't know the details. There are issues going on with the probate situation with Davey. So basically, they can't sell anything with his likeness in it. But of course, he's all over the video and the slideshow during the concerts.
Right.
All right.
And that's also, from what I understand, the reason why they're not saying his name in the shows since 2012.
Yeah, which was another thing that. My friend pointed out to me when she saw the tour in 2012, she's like, and my sister said the same thing. We walked out of there and they were like, you know, they kind of showed Davey on the screen, but they never referenced him and never said anything about him. Don't you think that's odd? And I didn't notice it during the show, but yeah, I thought that there was probably something at play that prevented them from doing so.
Mm-hmm. Was there any other cool merch that you noticed in 2011?
The tambourine. I think it was the first time I saw the tambourine, which I had to buy.
Oh, wow. That's cool.
And then I don't remember if it was that tour. It might have been 2012 where they had the head shirt, which sadly was gone by the time that I saw them. That might have been 2012, actually. I was very upset that I missed out on that. There was a button set. I believe they sold wool hats, you know, things like that.
Like we stated, that was unfortunately the last tour with Davey, and then he passed away.
Right.
But they hit the road in 2012.
Oh, boy, did they.
So do one of you guys want to go into what sort of led to that tour, if either one of you know how things sort of fell into place for that?
I write about this some on fandomlenses.com. I've actually done reviews of all of the shows I've been to in the last couple of years, both solo and group, and, well, there have been a lot, as we're all aware. from what I understand, there was talk of a 2012 show with all four of them before Davey passed, and it sounds like they were at least having discussions about it, and, you know, unfortunately, we'll never know what would have happened there. I like to think that everybody was going to come to the table and it would have been a wonderful experience, but obviously it was not to be. But we didn't really know any of that at the time when Davey died, and it was just such a shock to all of us when Davey passed, because that was certainly not, but I don't think anybody expected him to die first, and certainly not so young. So, you know, over the next few months, things were going on, and you'd hear these little rumblings, and I followed Nez on Facebook, and I will never forget the day. It was in August, I forget the exact date, but he just posted this one little one-liner comment: "We may be coming to your town." And it was like the universe, you know, everybody's like, oh my gosh, does that mean what we think it means? Does it, you know, and everybody's flipping out. And then the next day, of course, he posts the massive gazpacho post where he basically lists out, you know, his recipe for gazpacho, and at the end says, oh, by the way, we're going on tour, which of course is completely and utterly Nez. So, and of course everybody goes insane, and I know a lot of the venues did not expect the response they did. I went to the show in Cleveland, Ohio, because this is where two of my best Monkees friends in the world live in Ohio, so I flew up to go with them. And from what I understood, Stan, that show pretty much sold out in about 2 hours after the tickets went on sale. And it was like that for all of the dates, from what I understand. And it was just, it was sort of a combination of grief over Davey and shock that Mike was back in the picture, and it basically just turned into sort of this huge exercise in, I don't know, making lemonade out of lemons, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And that had been the first time that Nesmith toured with the band since, was it the Just Us era?
Just Us in the UK.
The four of them did a brief tour in the UK in 97.
And famously, we're supposed to tour the U.S., and Nez was not part of that.
Mm-hmm.
But take whatever story you will. You can watch the E! True Hollywood Story for details about that. But by the time they got to the U.S. from the U.K., Nez was no longer a part of it. We'll be right back.
It's funny because I remember when they did the big reunion in the 80s, I was, you know, in my very, very, very early teens. Unfortunately, mm-hmm. I wasn't able to go to any shows, but
same here, yeah.
My aunt and uncles were able to go, and they brought me a tour book, which I am still tearing my house apart looking for. It's in the bottom of a box that I have yet to find. I asked my aunt about this, and I was curious about your guys' take on this. Is overall feelings related to Nesmith's sort of reluctance to reunite with the guys and how that affected seeing the band whenever you did, contrast it with him being with the band now?
I mean, it's still kind of unreal to think about.
Mm-hmm.
Coming on as a Monkees fan in 86 and seeing them in 87, Nesmith was never part of the deal. And I mean, I was looking forward to seeing the four of them in 1996, but I don't know that, I mean, I wasn't a huge, I enjoy Just Us, but I wasn't a huge fan of it. And although I wanted to see the four of them, maybe there was just a sense that told me that it might not happen. I don't know. It all seemed, it was all very strange times. The TV special with Mike, like all that stuff. Looking back on it now, it's just all very strange. It was a strange mm-hmm. time. So words cannot even really express the thoughts that you'll finally see them with Nesmith.
Yeah.
And it was just unreal. And Sarah put it well. I mean, we're all eyes peeled and on Facebook looking for anything that Mike had to say, like, every day about it. And I mean, it was kind of interesting because he had done some shows in the UK, some solo shows, and was kind of embracing performing again.
Yeah.
So again, it's kind of unfortunate how this all falls together. We can say that the four of them might have done a headquarters tour. They might have done it without Davey, even, you know, had he not died. But whatever the circumstances, this is what happened. And I mean, it's still unreal to think about.
My overwhelming feeling, and I even wrote something about this on my website, is of gratitude. I got to see both versions of the Monkees with, you know, with Davey and with Mike. I've actually seen Mike with the Monkees more than I have Davey now. Mm-hmm. But all I can just feel is gratitude. And I think, I don't know, part of that is because a very dear friend of mine in the fandom passed away a couple of months after Davey did. And that just sort of colored so much of how I felt about that 2012 reunion. They're very different animals. I went to the 2001 show with Davey, and it was a wonderful experience. It was very good in its way, but it was almost more like a Broadway show. And I don't mean that in any sort of negative way. I am a big fan of musicals and stuff, and it had a very kind of staged professional vibe to it where it was about the show. But when you go to one of the shows in the last three tours, 2012, 2013, and I understand it was the same way this past month, it's a concert. It's about the music, first and foremost, in a way, at least in 2001, that maybe, I mean, it was always about the music, but it was also about kind of, there was a staginess there that was not there in the later shows, where it was a lot more garage band, really.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Do we want to jump to 2014? Because it seems like 2014 is where a lot of changes occurred in terms of what was going on stage and who was on stage.
I think the main thing that changed was that Aviva left the show and Cersei Link came on as a backup singer. If you have never heard Cersei Link, any of her solo stuff, she's got YouTube, she's got all kinds of CDs that she and Christian have done. You need to check her out because she is just an amazing voice.
Girlfriend of Christian Nesmith.
Yeah.
Who's on tour with the Monkees, yes?
Correct, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Has been since 2012.
Okay, so he was on that 2012 tour. All
right. Yeah.
Yes.
So I guess before we wrap this up, is there anything that you saw either on YouTube or read about online or heard from people or were at this show that sort of made this round of shows a little different? I guess the biggest difference is the video montage, probably.
The video montage is done by Jonathan Nesmith. And so it's just a different montage, I believe, that's being played. We've had this, you know, the same kind of video production during the last couple tours. The set list, sadly, from what I see, has remained pretty static. When they came out in 2013, there were, I think, three or four additional songs added. We had Words, Kind of Girl I Could Love.
Just like that, yeah.
I think there was Shades of Grey? There was something else.
Dorn to Summer.
That was this summer, Shades of Grey. There was a third song. Yeah. I can't quite. No Time.
No Time. Yes, that's it. Yeah. They swapped that out for Daily Nightly.
Right. Added the Door in a Summer, but I there hasn't been a lot of change other than that. There have been one or two songs from tour to tour. Nesmith seems to have a love towards putting together a chronological set list. I know his solo shows have been this way, and I have to believe that this is his hand on the Monkees set list, making them chronological, because you have the first two albums, and you have a Headquarters set, then a couple of songs from Pisces, and you have Going Down and Tapioca Tundra, and then the Head set. It's all very chronological. And I feel like if there's only going to be two or three songs switched out from tour to tour, the order needs to be switched up a bit. Because I don't think that the order of, like, the first, you know, it's basically the same set list with one or two songs swapped. And that's been a bit of a disappointment to me, and honestly the reason why I didn't go see them on this tour.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's certainly, if they had been closer, I might have gone, but I certainly wasn't going to get on a plane to see it just because it was very similar to two shows I'd already flown to, I'd flown to one, and the other, fortunately, was in my town.
Yeah.
But from what I understand, Peter sort of made noises along the lines that there would be a fall tour. I don't know this. I don't have any secret inside info. Mm-hmm. But from what I understand, the kind of the rumors floating around is that there is going to be a more substantial set list overhaul for the next time they go out.
I'll be there for that one, and so will you, Craig.
Yes. Do you think it's feasible that Nesmith could sort of bow out again at any moment? After tour commitments, at least.
I don't see that happening.
Yeah.
No. I think he's into it now.
Mm-hmm. And also, do you think now that we're in I guess what you want to call a groove, do you think we're going to see them out and about on the road through, I guess, what will have to be a 50th anniversary celebration?
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking there will at least be that.
Yeah.
And I could see them going right up until that, too. They seem to be enjoying it now. It's going well, you know. And if they're all enjoying it, why not?
Exactly.
I mean, like I said, the only thing is, I mean, you're going to have, I mean, there are a lot of fans that will go see them kind of to see them once. And once you've exhausted all of those people, all you have left are the diehards. And like I said, if it's it would require a pretty substantial set list change, and hopefully that does happen.
Yeah.
Because I would like to see a different show at this point. And it doesn't have to be 30 completely different songs, but drop Last Train to Clarksville as the opener. Put it somewhere else, you know. I go there and I know it's going to be Last Train to Clarksville, Papa Jean's Blues, you're Andy Griselda.
Yeah.
And if I went to see them now, that's exactly what would happen. So aside from those couple of songs, I know what song's coming next, and I don't want that. The best thing about the 2011 show, and I saw some spoilers online, but I didn't know the set list per se. So the next song coming was going to be a surprise, and that's what I needed a Monkey show.
Right on. So
although
having
Nesmith there is a pretty good consolation.
I would say so. So I guess all we can do is hope that they continue to hit the road and entertain us and take it as far as they can. So I guess that'll wrap up this discussion of the last couple of tours. Any final thoughts regarding the tours of the last couple of years?
Sarah?
There are two things that I will never forget about these past two tours, and I think they're both very kind of emblematic about what the Monkees have been about and what they have been certainly been about in the recent years. The first thing is November 2012, the fall 2012 tour, the first tour Nez was back for, and Daydream Believer. The gal they pulled from the audience just totally nailed the song. She Davy danced, and it was just everybody was singing along. The crowd was just absolutely going bananas, and it's just like that moment. It took you back to that time when you were 9 years old in your bedroom singing into your hairbrush. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And it's just how they rekindle that kind of magic. And then the other thing that I will always remember is the second concert I was able to go to in Tulsa last year. As we go along, actually, was my husband and I's first dance at our wedding. And Mickey did that while we were both standing there in the audience kind of dancing together. And that is a moment that I will never forget. And that's just kind of emblematic of the power that that kind of music can have in your lives and that the Monkees have in your lives. And all I can do is just feel very grateful that we've experienced the last few years.
Excellent. Craig.
That's a great moment, by the way. That's a good memory. For me, it was a matter of, in terms of the Mike tours, when I saw them in 2012, one song that I never, ever, ever expected to hear live was Daily Nightly. And to not only have them perform Daily Nightly, but for them to do the gag where Mike couldn't procure a Moog synthesizer for the stage, he proceeded to vocalize Moog noises while Mickey sang.
Great.
That was a great moment. So for the guy that didn't want to tour with the Monkees for years and was the holdout all these years, mm-hmm. to just be up there and be a complete goofball on stage during the song, absolutely worth the price of admission. And
amen.
Light up the children. were in a jam when Bobby Sherman bought the thing. I think, well, there goes that song forever.
And along those lines, I said during one of our previous episodes, but it bears repeating, in 2012, when they come out and hit the stage and they open with Last Train to Clarksville, that's just great. But when the second song is Papa Jean's Blues and you hear Mike's voice for the first time, it was chills. Words can't describe. It was absolutely incredible. And the whole place went nuts.
Uh-huh.
And Nesmith is really the star of these shows. I hate to kind of single that out on a stage where there are three guys, but I mean, it at least the shows that I saw, he got the biggest response, and I think he felt a lot of appreciation at these shows, and I think that's why he keeps doing it.
Yeah, that's excellent that everybody could get to a place where they were comfortable enough to do what they're doing. It is really, really nice to see, and I do look forward to the time where I'm able to go see them. I think being a part of this podcast now is going to guarantee that I catch a show.
Yeah, and if you don't, we'll never let you live it down.
Uh-huh.
It'll be mentioned every episode.
Well, thank you for listening, and join us on the next Zilch. Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you.
Thank you, Craig.
Thanks, as always, Ken.
And Craig Smith.
Great.
And Jeff Hewlett as well. Thank you, guys, and we thank you for spending some time with us. And don't forget to monkey around. You ready, guys?
Here we go. Walking down the street. We get the funniest looks from
me. Isn't that dumb?
And that's our show. Zilch is an online nonprofit Monkees audio fanzine made by fans for fans. Any samples of music or interviews heard remain property of their owners. We are not related to the Monkees or any of their members past or present. We are not affiliated with Rhino or Ray Burke. If you hear anything you like from the band, go on Amazon or iTunes and buy it. If you enjoyed the show, like us on Facebook and rate us on iTunes. Thank you for listening. Until next time, I'm your announcer, Chelsea Epstein, saying always take some time to monkey around.